Welcome back to the program. Back in the 1930s and 40s, multitasking was not a buzzword. Women were not trying to have it all, and Hollywood represented the apotheosis of beauty, surface, and dreams. Yet out of this emerged a woman who not only was considered at the time the most beautiful woman in the world, but gave us the technology that today powers our cell phones, our GPSs, and our Bluetooth. A woman of brains and beauty, Hedy Lamarr was the true Renaissance woman. Yet her story has been little known until now, when Pulitzer Prize winner Richard Rhodes gives us new insight into the complexity and intellectual depth of Hedy Lamarr. Richard Rhodes is the author of Twilights of the Bomb, the last volume in his landmark quartet of books about nuclear history. The first volume, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, won the Pulitzer Prize as well as the National Book Award. It is my pleasure to welcome Richard Rhodes back to this program to talk about Hedy's Folly, the life and breakthrough inventions of Hedy Lamarr. Richard Rhodes, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Why is this such a little-known story?
You know, I think because for so many years it got lost in military secrecy. The invention that we'll be talking about was classified until the late 1970s, having been made during early in the Second World War. So there was a long stretch when it was hidden.
It's interesting that the military aspect of this runs through, in some respects, the entire story, because when she was back in Austria, Hedy Lamarr was married to an Austrian arms manufacturer.
Indeed, the third wealthiest man in the country, who not only made the bullets for the Italian and German armies up until the war, but also was much involved in helping the Nazi Germans developed the technology for torpedoes, submarines, aerial torpedoes, things like that they were having problems with, as everyone was at first.
Before she came to Hollywood, when she was in this marriage in Austria, you talk about the fact that Nazi generals used to routinely visit their home. She would sit and listen to these conversations.
Hedy married Fritz Mandl when she was 20 years old. She was, I think, what we would call today an arm piece or a trophy wife, and as always in her life, struggled with the fact that nobody could see past her beauty. They just assumed she had no substance beyond that. So sitting bored at dinner while Nazi admirals and generals in Italian the same were sitting around discussing their technical problems, she absorbed a lot of knowledge about these issues.
But, of course, her interest in all of this started long before. You talk about her relationship with her father, the long walks that they used to take. Talk a little about that.
Well, I think you have to ask, when someone like this, whose education was that of an upper-middle-class young woman in Vienna in the years between the wars, which is to say she learned dance and piano and comportment and presumably the usual literature and so forth, but probably not technological studies. You have to ask where this interest came from. Her father was a bank director, and although he was not himself an engineer or anything like that, he himself was interested in technology. She was his only child. He adored her. She adored him. And they used to take long walks together through Vienna. And he would, to make conversation with his child, explained to her how things worked, how the bus was propelled, how the steam engine that drove the electricity generator worked. So she absorbed not only an interest in technology, but also an interest in technology colored by her emotional, happy, loving connection with her father. I think that's probably where this interest came from, because she sustained it throughout her life.
Of course, it was at a time when there wasn't an easy or any kind of obvious outlet for that interest for her.
Exactly. And her first focus, let's be clear, was on being a movie star, which seems to have been something she decided upon when she was a little girl.
Where did that interest come from?
You know, I don't know, except that she was, well, one source clearly was Vienna. Vienna in those days was a city in Austria, was a community that had not really done very well politically over the centuries and had increasingly become focused on culture and the arts as a way for Austria to identify itself as a country. So, for example, one writer who speaks of the Austria of the pre-World War I days, he says, people didn't go to the theater just to see the theater. They went to learn how to dress. They went to learn how to speak and how to comport themselves. In that context, you can see how a child whose beauty was already obvious by the time she was six might have become very interested. Plus, she was an only child, so she had the problem of how to amuse herself. She set up a theater under her father's desk at home and used to imitate everyone in her life. She describes herself as having been a stage on which she played out the characters of everyone around her. So, as is usually the case with people who are very good at something as adults, she started working on it when she was a small child.
In that sense, the first invention that she really came up with was herself.
That's a wonderful point. Yes, indeed. She invented the person who became Hedy Lamarr. But, you know, that was a trap for her because she was a different person behind that beautiful exterior and even behind that acting skill than the person people expected.
She finally escapes Austria, escapes this very cloistered marriage that she's in. But even then, the story that she tells about how she escapes is a kind of invented story.
Yes. The traditional biographies of Hedy Lamarr have retailed her story, or perhaps the MGM press department story, I don't know, that she studied one of her maids who looked somewhat like her, and then drugged the maid one day when she was ready to go, donned the maid's costume outfit, jumped out the window and escaped to the train station and took off for Paris to get a divorce. Well, I looked in United States newspapers from the day that were splashed with headlines about this young actress, Hedwig Kiesler, getting a divorce in Vienna from her husband because he wouldn't let her act in a particular play. So that was just a made-up story. But she did have to escape from this man who almost literally kept her locked up in what she called her golden prison. And one of the ways she prepared for that was to listen carefully at these dinner parties with these military technicians, hoping she could come across something that she could use, if she had to blackmail Fritz Mann.
She goes to see Louis B. Mayer. Talk about that story.
Well, she was actually in London, and Mayer came over there trying to pick up as many actors and actresses as he could on the cheap at this time when so many people, particularly Jews, were fleeing Europe because the Nazis were rapidly taking power in Germany and Austria. And she went to see him in London, and he offered her almost nothing weekly as a salary if she would pay her own way to the United States. And she basically said, well, that's not good enough, and walked out. Then, cleverly, she found out which ocean liner he was sailing back to the United States on, booked a ticket on the same liner, and did a little bit of acting, made sure he saw her flirting with the handsome young men aboard. And by the time the ship landed in New York, she had a contract for about $3,000 a week with the proviso that she would learn English as quickly as possible.
Once this acting career takes off, she still is looking at the inventing part of it as kind of a hobby for her.
She had the problem in Hollywood that she didn't drink. She didn't like to go to parties. Her idea of a pleasant evening was a quiet dinner party with some intelligent friends. I'd like to point out in the book that she used to play chess with Man Ray, who was an American photographer of great repute from the days in Paris in the 20s. She was not a stupid person at all. She was quite bright. So she had to fill her time. And by then, I guess she had started noticing that she had a knack for seeing solutions to life's little problems. So she set up an inventing room in her house with a drafting table and drafting lights and the proper tools and a wall full of technical reference texts that she might need. and began a hobby of inventing things. One of her inventions that she wrote about in one of her books with a laugh was a tablet that you could drop into a glass of water and it would fizz up and make a Coke. And Howard Hughes, whom I guess she might have dated at some point, loaned her a couple chemists to help her make this thing work. She laughed later and said it never really did, although it sounded to me like if you had a hangover, an Alka-Seltzer tablet with some caffeine in it.
Sounds like a good idea.
A pretty good idea.
Who knew that she was doing this, that she had set up this room, that she had this hobby, and how did other people react to it?
You know, that's interesting. I didn't see much comment from other people early on about this hobby of hers. But it's hard to think that she didn't tell people about it. So we know Howard Hughes was aware of it. And I would suspect that the friends she would have dinner with were aware of it as well.
Part of what drove her to her penultimate invention was this sense of the coming war and her concerns about that. Talk about that, Richard.
Well, she was keenly aware of the developing war in Europe, and remember that the war began in Europe on September 1st, 1939, so the United States was basically a neutral party until the attack on Pearl Harbor 70 years ago yesterday, as a matter of fact, which brought the United States into the war. So she was living in this country, but following the developing war in Europe, and particularly in the summer of 1940, when the pact between the British and the German Navy that protected British shipping for a while had broken down, and the Germans had basically declared the entire North Atlantic open season on any ships, whether civilian or military, that were sailing there out of England. Well, the English at that point, aware that the German bombing campaign was coming, the so-called Blitz, when London was bombed and the rest of England, were moving their children in large numbers out of England into safety in Canada, using passenger liners to carry them. And that summer, two successive passenger liners loaded with English children were torpedoed by the German Navy. One of them, too, luckily, no loss of life except one member of the crew, but none of the children. But the second one, there were 99 children aboard and 70 drowned as a result of that torpedoing. Hetty was horrified. And in her way, I mean, this was a supremely self-confident person. In her way, she decided she was going to do something about it. She was going to find a way to stop the German submarines from attacking shipping.
And the way she came up with this was the idea of this radio-guided torpedo. Talk about how that invention evolved.
She was aware from her time with her husband, Fritz Mandl, that torpedo technology was pretty bad. Early German torpedoes weren't very good at finding their targets. In fact, they weren't guided at all. And American torpedoes were a disaster until late in the Second World War. They just simply were badly designed, and it took a long time to find out what their multiple problems were. So in this context, Hetty had heard conversations over dinner about the possibility of guiding torpedoes. The system the Germans ultimately developed was to use a spool of wire about a mile and a half long that was played out behind the torpedo as it shot forward, and that allowed an operator in the submarine to guide it through an electrical connection between the two. She saw another idea that she thought was better, which was radio guidance. A plane overhead would be able, if the torpedo had an antenna trailing behind it, to send a signal to the torpedo, and of course could see its track in the water, and guide it directly toward whatever ship they intended to hit. So this was a good idea, but then she realized that there would be the problem of the signal being jammed, because jamming a radio signal was already an available technology. And this is where her invention came. The central piece of her idea, what was new about her idea, was that if you could make the frequency of the radio signal jump around, if you could make the radio signal jump from frequency to frequency and synchronize the torpedo receiver with the airplane transmitter, then no one would be able to keep track of its moving around fast enough to jam it. So that was the essence of her idea.
Talk about how that idea evolved, this idea of signal hopping frequency hopping, moving from frequency to frequency.
She discussed this over dinner one evening with some friends, including someone she had invited to join them for dinner, an American avant-garde composer named George Antile. Now, the reason she wanted Antile to dinner wasn't torpedo technology. She didn't know yet that he might have some knowledge that would help her. But he had been trying to make a living as an avant-garde composer and had done a lot of other things, including writing a series of articles for Esquire magazine about the effects of hormones on the body and the mind and the personality. So she wanted to know. Louis B. Mayer, her boss at MGM, had been telling her breasts were too small for a number of years. She thought maybe Antile could help her find out how to make her breasts larger, and that's why she wanted to have him to dinner. But once they got past that discussion, and as they were talking, Antile had spent more than 10 years in Paris writing his music and becoming a friend of all the crowd there, Hemingway and Gertrude Stein and Picasso and so forth. He was very much a part of that scene before he moved back to the United States and then to Hollywood. Antile was also very concerned about the European scene. He had a younger brother who had been one of the first diplomats for the U.S. State Department killed in the war. So he had a personal feeling that he'd like to help out. And it turned out, as Hedy learned in talking with him, that he, at the age of 18, had been, of all things, a munitions inspector at a munitions factory in the United States during the First World War. So he had some kind of knowledge that she thought she could use. And these two people then got together and began thinking about how to make a radio control system frequency hopping for a torpedo.
And they ultimately created this, got a patent for it, as this secret communication system that they then wanted to give free to the Navy.
They did. And the centerpiece of their patent application, let me just say, a patent is two things. It's a new idea, one that has not been thought of before. But it also, to get a patent, has to be embodied in a practical mechanism, as the patent law says. So that means that if you have an idea like frequency hopping, you have to show how it would work by designing a device that would incorporate it. Now, the device doesn't have to be the only way that it could work, but it does have to be one that would work. So they drew on Antile's knowledge of player piano technology, of all things, to make the practical embodiment of their invention. Antile had written a composition in Paris called the Ballet Mécanique that had been designed for 16 player pianos synchronized all to play the same music at the same time. It was his method of amplifying the sound, the volume, in the days before you had electrical means to do that. They both then realized that if you developed a strip of tape, paper tape, let's say, and had holes punched in it, kind of like the tape in a player piano, that would be a mechanism for moving the frequency around. As the hole came into the mechanism and the mechanism read the hole, it would move the frequency from one channel to another. So this was what they used as an idea of how you might embody it. And this was the patent that they got, and this was the patent they gave to the Navy. And the poor Navy officers in charge of this technology, I mean, they didn't have a torpedo that would work in the first place. 60% of our torpedoes in the Second World War missed their targets. And the idea that you would then have, well, this is what they thought. They said to Antile, you mean you want to put a player piano in a torpedo? They just didn't understand. Antile said later, you know, this could have been a wire, and it could have been the size of a wristwatch, which is true, of course. And indeed, that's what we have inside of our wireless telephones today. We have the same mechanism, but it isn't a player piano mechanism anymore.
And after the Navy didn't use it, after they didn't understand it, it just sort of disappeared for a while, this invention.
Because, yes, exactly, because as soon as the Navy got this patent, they classified it secret. And that means it was invisible to the world, except within the Navy's own technological departments. But as it happened, in 1954, someone in the Navy engineering realm noticed it and thought, well, let's see if this would work today when we have the transistors and other mechanisms for making this system small. So they passed it over to one of the engineering firms that worked under contract to the Navy to see if it could be used for a device called a sonobuoy. This was something that a buoy, of course, is a thing that floats on top of the water. This would have a sonar system built into it that would look down and therefore possibly detect a passing submarine, and then to send a signal up to a plane overhead that was monitoring a number of different sonobuoys, they would use frequency hopping so the signal couldn't be jammed. Well, they built this thing, and it didn't work terribly well because there was no GPS in those days, and it was hard to know where the sonobuoy was. But that began the process of the Navy realizing that frequency hopping to prevent jamming was a very valuable technique. And it was then applied to ship-to-ship radio communications, to control radio between the ground and a missile. And then a little later, when the military began developing what came to be called GPS, which was also secret for many years before it was released to the rest of us, they used it for the communications between the GPS satellites and the ground, and it still is used that way today whenever we use GPS. So the military then saw the value of this technology and applied it all over the place. To this day, military communications use frequency hopping to protect them from being jammed.
Of course, in the intervening period, the patent had expired, and Hetty wasn't going to get any of the benefit from it.
No, and I think at that point, her concern was mostly that no one had acknowledged that she had done this important thing. She just felt, as she felt throughout her Hollywood years, that no one understood who she was, that her face, which she once said was her curse, I mean, it's ironic, because she was happy to use her beauty and her acting skills for her career, even though she really never got the roles she thought she could handle, because, again, people couldn't see past her beauty. But she wanted to be recognized as an intelligent human being who had a self beyond this face of hers, and that never really happened to her in Hollywood. She even reached the point where she bought out her contract with MGM in 1945 and started her own production company, hoping that she could do better then. So she was someone who wanted the recognition that as long as this patent was secret, she wasn't going to get. But in the late 1970s, the military began to declassify a lot of technologies that were now mature and that all the other military services around the world had, so there was no reason to keep them secret any longer. And they were turned over to the FCC for possible development for civilian use. The first application of frequency hopping after that was for car phones, which were, of course, the first manifestation of wireless cell phone technology. And then they had another use, because if a car phone, if there was only one frequency available for each car phone, and they all, if car phones used the same frequency, they would interfere with each other. And there were only, let's say, 20 or 30 available single frequencies for car phones, so you could only have 20 or 30 car phones talking at the same time. Ah, but if you switched over to frequency hopping, you could have thousands talking at the same time. And thus, this technology began to be applied for cell phones, the next step. The cell phone manufacturers found a cheaper technology that they use for most of our cell phones today that involved a time shift rather than a frequency shift. But all our wireless phones in our homes still use frequency hopping. And Bluetooth, the technology that was developed so that low-powered instruments can talk to each other, of course, Bluetooth is used all over today. Bluetooth also uses frequency hopping. GPS continues to use it. The military continues to use it. And I believe there are cell phone systems in Europe that use it. So Hetty, of course, as she moved into her old age and she lived into her 80s, had the problem still that no one knew this was something she had done. And as late as 1990, in an interview for a business magazine, she said, these people just take and use you, and then they just never acknowledge what you've done. So she was still kind of offended that, anyway, finally, some of the early pioneers of wireless communications realized where this technology had come from, had looked at the patent and saw her married name on it. That's one of the reasons it wasn't acknowledged, because she wasn't listed as Hedy Lamarr. She was listed as Hedvig Markey, her married name at the time. But a couple of people whom I interviewed who were cell phone pioneers and wireless digital pioneers worked it all out and figured it out and began a movement to get her an award. And she was, in 1998, awarded an award from the Pioneer Digital Pioneer Foundation. And she was absolutely delighted. In fact, when they called her up to tell her that they were going to give her this award, her first words in her Austrian accent were, "Well, it's about time."
Right up until the end, she was continuing to work on inventions and ideas and things to try and improve the world. She tried to even improve the supersonic transport, the Concorde.
She had some kind of idea to make the Concorde better. She had an idea for a more effective stoplight. She was working on little things, too. She had an idea for a little box that would attach to a Kleenex box so that you'd have a place to put your Kleenex after you've blown your nose. I mean, she was just simply looking around all the time for ways to make things better. She had a chair that would swing in and out of a shower so that someone who couldn't stand in the shower would be able to shower efficiently. These were, you know, she simply looked at the world the way, I guess, a good inventor, engineer would look at the world. And in these years when she was finally getting this award, she talked on the phone with someone who happens to live near me here in Northern California, a man named Nino Amarena, who is himself an engineer and inventor. And he said, "We talked for 45 minutes just as fast as we could, like two inventors excited to be talking to someone else who understands how you do these things." He said there was no sense that she was a haughty movie star or anything else. We were just a couple of people talking about inventions. So she kept that aspect of her character alive through her life.
Richard Rhodes, the book is Hetty's Folly, The Life and Breakthrough Inventions of Hedy Lamarr. It's just out from Doubleday. Richard, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.